This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This episode is brought to you by the Great American Magic Company, purveyors of fine magic. And right now they have a Labor Day flash sale that is going on for Friends of the Magic Word, where a free gift is given for each purchase to people who are Friends of the Magic Word. And if you're interested in joining, now's another good reason why that you should join up and help be a patron of the Magic Word. Just go to themagicwordpodcast.com. You can click on a link, find out how that you can give a one-time donation, or also if you want to become an ongoing monthly pledge patron, that would be appreciated also. So any help that you can give would be deeply appreciated, and you get some pretty good perks if you do become a monthly donor, as well as, of course, this immediate one right now. If you're planning on purchasing something from the Great American Magic Company, you get a free gift. Again, that's part of their Labor Day flash sale. So thank you, Eric Citron, for sponsoring this episode. I also want to mention that later in this podcast, you will hear a presentation that was given by David Charvet on the Willard family, and specifically the lineage of Willard the Wizard, and those who had preceded Harry Willard and his father and grandfather and all the rest of that, that David Charvet had presented this before the group of us who were in the Order of Willard. And the Order of Willard is for members of the Texas Association of Magicians who have 25 years or more of consecutive membership within the organization. So this was a luncheon that we had for the group of us that David had presented this quite scholarly talk. He had written a book. It had taken him a couple of years of his life, actually, to compose this and put it all together, and then it was published then by Mike Caveney. It's about to go out of print. He happened to have two or three copies still left available, which sold immediately after his little presentation. But I thought from an historical standpoint, and particularly because of the importance of not only Willard being perhaps the world's greatest magician, but also because of his association or long association with Texas and then the Texas Association of Magicians. But I think just from an historical perspective that you might enjoy and learn something. So enjoy this podcast from day two of the Texas Association of Magicians here in Frisco, Texas. Good morning. This is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and it's a Saturday morning on September the 2nd, and we're here at breakfast, just enjoying the Embassy Suites free breakfast, all full buffet, very nice, and a lot of people are here, and one of the people you're going to see if you're at the convention or if you attend before the weekend's over, come on down, you know, or come on up or over or wherever you are, come on over to Frisco and enjoy this. But this gentleman is going to be our lecturer on Monday morning. And also, you may have heard him when he had come through and lectured for us a few years back. And here he is, Doug Anderson. Hi there, Doug.
Scott, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Very good to see you again. It's been a while. Matter of fact, last time was, I think, when you were coming through Houston.
Stayed with you guys in Houston when you booked me for the Southern...
lecture tour.
Almost said Southern Comfort, but yeah, it wasn't that. Yeah, so the Southern lecture tour. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Yeah. A lot of good folks.
Well, I'm glad that you're here at this convention. This is kind of, in a way, not too far away from where you are in Oklahoma, where you live.
Actually, this is about 6 hours away. So people that drove in, say, here from Midland, it's about the same distance as Midland, Texas,
realize.
Is here.
Yeah,
we live up in the far northeast corner of the state in Grove, okay. Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. But just glad that we were able to make it with all the problems that have been happening and the gas shortages, things, and whatever else that we were able to make it. Because I know a lot of our friends and fellow magicians weren't able to make it due to the problems that's going on in Houston.
Right.
And everybody I've talked with here, that seems to be on the top of a lot of people's minds, just concern for friends and family that couldn't make it.
That has been the hallmark, or you know, one thing that has been discussed a lot, you know, here at the convention. Well, I want to talk a little bit about, this is a nice facility. You know, I think here at Embassy Suites, I mentioned breakfast and I got free happy hour. It's a great hotel.
Wait, you know. Free happy hour?
Yes.
Why do people not tell me these things? Well, now I know. But yeah, you know what? You're right. This is a great hotel, and the personnel here have been very good, very nice. The rooms are nice. I'm talking about the rooms that we're staying in.
They're remodeled,
The lecture hall, the performing hall, it's all very, very nice. Top notch.
Yeah, we are right next to the convention center, which is actually connected to the hotel. So
it's just a short walk around the corner inside. You don't have to get outside, you know, in the Texas heat, so it's very nice.
The people here in the Dallas Club have done a great job at putting this together.
They have. Last night's show that we saw Gregory Wilson and Christian and Catalina, what did you think of the show?
Hilarious.
Yeah.
Great job. I really like mentalism and what they did with it. The amount of comedy, and that's not just me talking. People I've had breakfast with were also talking about it, that they really enjoyed it. And a couple of the people that I actually had breakfast with said, we don't really like mentalism, but we really liked last night's show. they were funny.
Yeah.
They had just the right amount of humor combined with the mentalism. Had some fairly strong effects as well.
Yes.
And, of course, Gregory, just incredible.
It was very good. You know, another point to Christian and Catalina, there are several duos, you know, like the Evisons and Tommy Ten and Emily and others who are mind readers, mind reading acts. And, of course, Christian and Catalina have a little bit of that, but that wouldn't be what I would say would be the bulk of their act. In other words, you're not going to be remembering them necessarily. There are different parts of their acts. To me, what I thought was really interesting that I've never seen other acts do is it seems like that you were getting a peek inside of their lives. In other words, they're talking with each other on stage. So they're kind of saying, well, we should have rehearsed this a little bit more, or whatever. You know, they just kind of have some funny lines back and forth, you know.
They were very comfortable working together,
you go, yeah.
And you can tell that they really, really enjoyed entertaining last night. And that means so much to, you know, people that sadly sometimes we tend to get jaded or, oh, that old joke again. But, I mean, you know what? They did it well. They did it great. Yeah. And because of the marriage, because they get along together so well, or certainly appears that way, that it came across on stage. And, you know, they probably could have been selling Amway products or, you know, not to disparage Amway, but they could have been doing anything.
Right.
And they still would have been entertaining and people still would have watched them.
Right.
But the fact that they were skilled and talented and the mental effects that they were showing us just made it that much better.
Yeah, and again, I think it was kind of like a sitcom from the standpoint that, you know, you're
that's
kind
a good
of peeking
observation.
Into their life.
Yeah, a sitcom.
Yeah. Well, both of those acts were their first-timers to the TAOM, and that's one of the things that Frank Seltzer was trying to do is to bring in some people who perhaps have been seen at other conventions but have never been seen at TAOM, because we do have a lot of attendees here who only attend the TAOM annually.
Yes, and I'm glad that he has this particular group of people together. In fact, I'm quite surprised that the weather here is as pleasant as it is right now because... It's kind of warm, and I was expecting it to be snowing outside, because last time I lectured at TAOM was 20 years ago. I know, because that's when Princess Diana was killed, and now it's the anniversary 20 years later, but I remember being told then it'll be a cold day before you ever lecture again at TAOM, and here I am, I'm back, and it's not cold, so something has changed, who knows what.
That's funny. So there are more activities and things we got going on over here today, and we're going to be. They got a pretty full dealers room. There's some other some good dealers. I've already bought some stuff.
Yes, and catching up with Michelle Osborne.
Yes, Paul Osborne's
widow. Yeah, just so wonderful.
You got to be good friends, because I'm sure that when you were working cruises and theme parks, particularly theme parks, you and Paul probably were close.
Yeah.
And by the way, Paul Osborne is the person here. This convention is dedicated to his memory since he had recently passed.
That's a wonderful, wonderful tribute to a wonderful man. Paul and I and Michelle, they treated us magicians that perform theme park shows almost like their kids, surrogate kids, as it were, and I really loved them both. Paul and I, he's a progressive, I'm an ultra-conservative, so we kind of went our separate ways in the past several years, but we reconnected, fortunately, not too long before he finally passed away, so I was happy for that. But I'm glad that they are honoring him, and all the people that have ever done a theme park show for Paul or whatever else, I think owe a debt of gratitude to this man that they are honoring, Paul Osborne.
For some of you who are listening to this, and particularly the younger people who may not know the name Paul Osborne, he used to have a running monthly column in Genie Magazine that was, they were the blueprints, illusions that were in there every month.
Tips and ideas and tricks if you already have an illusion, how to refurbish it or repaint it and those kind of things to make it more sturdy. And as you said, some of his illusion plans that he sells, he gave away for free in Genie Magazine.
Right.
And he was an incredibly gifted artist as well.
I never got a chance to meet him. I knew he lived in Dallas, but for some reason our paths never crossed, even in the years I lived here. So I never
He cracked me up, and whenever we would get together for a meal, he and I would always fight for that that chair that's back in the corner so you can survey the entire room so nobody sneaks up on you. But we finally reached a compromise that we moved chairs, spun the table around so we both had our backs to a wall.
That's funny. Well, it's been a good convention, and it's only just started, really. This is the first full day.
I'm so looking forward to this. I've been looking forward to this for a long time, and I'm really glad with the caliber of talent that Frank has put together for this conference. I love the amenities, the facilities that they have here, and it is good to see y'all both again, too.
Well, good to see you, Doug, and I would encourage people to go back into the archives of themagicwordpodcast.com and just click on the archives and do a search then for Doug Anderson. I believe it was called On Dry Ground because he had done a lot of cruise ships and, of course, theme parks, and just has a varied history and is a good one. I would recommend that you go back. You know, there are a ton of things. That must have been, golly, 2012, 13, somewhere back in there.
I remember gas prices were $2.65 a gallon back then, and I was not making any money at all on that lecture tour. But and I'm glad you said varied. I used to say sorted, and that's a better word, varied. Sorted past, varied past.
And so that was Doug Anderson. So for the Magic Word Podcast, this is
Scotty
out. All right, well, we just are finishing up with Brent Braun's lecture over here, and I'm with half of the stars from last night over here, and I'm not referring to Gregory Wilson. But half the other half, I guess. Here we go with Catalina Painter. Hi there, Catalina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thank
you.
What's going
on?
Well, how late did it go last night? I didn't stick up for the real world.
Oh, it went late. The lecture actually ended about 1 a.m., and then we stayed out till about 4.
Had another cigar
or
something.
It was late. That's right.
That's what I was. Well, I was up until about 1:30 or 2 getting the podcast out for the next day for everybody.
So you were working.
I was working.
We were having
fun. Yeah, that's right. Well, tonight I'm going to try to get out to join you guys.
So. Awesome.
Good. So this is your first time at a TAOM. Have you ever actually even attended a TAOM?
Never.
Okay.
Never.
I know that was one of the things that Frank Seltzer wanted to do, is to have some people here who had never attended and performed at a convention.
Always heard great things.
And is it meeting your expectations?
That's awesome. We're having a blast.
Aren't you?
Everybody's
though?
Super, super nice. Come on, we know everybody in Texas is super
nice.
Well,
you know a lot of us anyhow, you know, I mean, from Texas.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
Now, have you worked over before at Richard Pitchford's place at the Peacock Theater here in town, Frisco?
No.
You're familiar with that, though?
I am not.
You're not?
I am not.
Okay, well, you know who Richard Pitchford is. That is the owner of Genie Magazine, you know, that bought that from Richard Kaufman. Mm-hmm. And that he also is the owner and creator of Gearbox Company. Anyhow, that he's got a theater in town.
That's
kind of like
a
Brookledge. You know,
cool. Awesome.
And so,
how long has he had that?
Yeah, about a year and a half. You know, amazing
recent.
Jonathan and you know, Paul V. Hill. And a lot of guys come out and work this from time to time.
Awesome.
You need to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly small. Have you been out and worked at Rookledge, by the way, then too?
Or no,
you haven't there either.
Mm-mm.
Well, you guys are working a lot of colleges, but also you got your own theater. So
that's right. So we have our
Indianapolis.
Own show. So correct.
Is that right?
So
tell me more about that.
That's a show we do every week in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our own theater show at the Hilton. We love it. Doing it for about 7 years now.
And when you're not there, is there anybody that comes in and takes your place?
No, it's just us.
That's what I was wondering. You know, sometimes the guy, I was talking like with Rick Wilcox. You know, he's got his show up in Wisconsin Dells. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he's not there, it's dark. You know,
right.
They really, whereas, let's say like with, you know, when Matt King's going to be out, he's got somebody filling in for him or something. Or even, I know Murray Sawchuk has some guys occasionally who's in town will, you know.
Yeah, like help him out, do maybe 20 minutes or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure.
Right, right. So have you ever filled in for anybody like that or done something like that in Vegas? Or?
We have not. We toured for 10 years, and mm-hmm. then after that, we started our own show. So,
yeah. I know.
I mean, when you have a show every week, you're there.
Right.
You're in Indianapolis, so that's your home base. That's it.
So you're really only able to do the corporate shows, unless they're really well-paying, during the weekdays.
That's right. Correct. I mean, they can buy us out. I mean, that's fine. If they want to pay a lot of money, we'll do it.
Do you have buyouts for your theater sometimes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
And how big is this theater?
About 65 seats.
Okay. And is it really a banquet room, and then you set it up and then tear it down every week, or is it a standing, like a comedy club thing, or what is it? What's the venue look like there?
It is. It's a, that depends. So sometimes we stay set up, sometimes we tear it down. It just depends mm-hmm. on what is going on, and it's in our contract to negotiate how we do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's essentially we take care of everything in the room and how it looks and what the feel is, and we turn into a theater feel, and because we want that experience when they walk in the room not to be in just a plain room. Mm-hmm. So we turn it into a theater and really make that feel like, wow, you're coming into something special.
You put curtains on the walls and
do it? Uh-huh. We do all that.
Because I know, like in Steve Cohen's situation with his theater there, well, which used to be at the Ritz, I guess it's basically still just a room.
Okay, you know. Look, when you're in the Waldorf Astoria and you're in a suite, probably don't need to do anything else with that. That's probably amazing in and of
good
itself.
Point. That's
so,
a good point. Good point.
A little different situation.
And what about the college circuit? I know that you had traveled a lot.
Oh, we haven't done that in a long time.
In a while.
Yeah, we haven't done that. That was great. It was fantastic. We loved it. But, this is our new adventure we've been doing.
And the book right now that is the e-book that...
Michael Close?
Yep, you and Michael Close have put out. Mm-hmm. So tell me something about that. What's the title?
So
where can
Christian
they get that?
So Christian was the brainstorm behind that. He said, you know what, let's talk to the experts in all the different markets that are out there mm-hmm. and get their opinion on what it's like to work in that market. Mm-hmm. And so he said, that's going to be my column, what it's like to work in the real world. Mm-hmm. And then Michael Close thought it was fantastic. And so he put all of them together in this e-book. And it's on michaelclose.com is where you can get that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's something that's been out there like the last couple of months or something,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, very,
right?
Very recent. I think month?
Maybe a month.
Yeah, maybe a month.
Wow.
Hasn't been out for that long at all.
What was the most surprising thing that you found about
it? What's that, Heather? What?
What's the most surprising thing after putting it all together? What was the most
surprising good question. Thing for you? She was asking, what was the most surprising thing after putting it together? What was the most surprising thing for you?
I don't think it was putting it together. That it was when you talk to the experts in their field.
Yeah.
I think people need to know there's so many different markets out there, mm-hmm. and you have to decide what is the market for me. What is the market I enjoy performing in? What is the market that I think I might excel in? What is the market that I want to do? And so you might have to try your hand in a few more. Oh, you might decide, oh, that market's not for me. I really didn't like that at all. Oh, but this one I really like. So it just takes time. But remember, any market you go into, you have to put a lot of research and effort into making it work in that market. You're not just going to say, oh, I want to work the corporate market, and then tomorrow you have a show. That's not how it works in any market. Right. Any market.
Or any profession for that matter. I mean, you can't be an expert overnight. Or, you know,
exactly.
You can't
you're exactly
run
right.
for office. There's so many things. Whatever you're going
to
do. Yeah.
That's right. You have to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, right. And so what is the biggest lesson out of that whole book, would you say?
Oh, geez. Holy cow.
What are the top three? Yeah. What comes to mind?
I haven't even had coffee yet.
Oh, so you're up late this morning.
Yes, I need to get my coffee. The biggest lesson? Wow.
I mean, if people are going to buy the book, what would be the one thing you think that they should get out of it?
The difference between reality and myth.
That's true.
Right. What you think being a professional entertainer is not what it is.
You're always going to, look, you think you're ready. You think you're ready to become a professional. And what these articles are meant to help you out with is, look, here's what you have to be prepared for if you're going to go into this market. You're never going to be 100% prepared. You think you are, you're not. Understand that. You're not totally prepared. Just jump in if you want to. But remember, you have to learn, get feedback, don't be afraid of feedback, and people telling you how you need to get better.
Yeah.
Understand you're never where you think it is.
Right.
And then you just have to
you're
learn and
learning.
Grow from there.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I would say this, for people who are just starting, and it was the same with us, you think you're a 9. On a scale of 1 to 10, you think your show's a 9. And then you find out you're a 5, maybe. And then you get a little better. But you're still not as good as you think you are, and it's a constant process. And I don't think people are really ready for that reality, because it's crushing when you find out you're a 5. And then you're like, oh my God, I gotta go see directors. I gotta find a way to make myself better. And I think that's one of the hardest things for people. Aside from the business side, when you find out all the business you have to do, it's that I'm not as good as I thought I was.
Right. Well, interesting. Well, good. Thank you, guys. I'm glad you're enjoying the convention, the TAOM in Dallas. I'm glad that the weather is good here then also for you.
I mean, beautiful here.
You know, we're going to be having it in Houston next year, and I'm glad we didn't have it this year.
Oh,
yes,
nice.
We are.
Nice.
So, and you guys have been down to Houston before. I remember when I first met you, and
that's
I think
right.
when seeing Banachek's show.
Ago,
yeah,
huh?
It was many years ago. That's right. But then they said, yeah, we'll be there then next year. Jamie Selene is going to be the incoming president. But, yeah, I don't know what we would have done, you know, this year. Would have been... I don't know, we could have held it at all, even, you know, that's true.
No, you probably couldn't have, not with the devastation that's down there.
Yeah,
wow, that would be tough.
Yeah, it'd be tough. But yes, it's a great venue they've got here at the Embassy Suites and everything. Now, you guys don't work a lot of conventions, though, do you?
No, it's rare.
So it was kind of a favor for Frank, or just how'd that come about?
Yeah, Frank is great.
The timing worked out.
Timing worked out. Frank's like, come on, you got to come out. And we're like, all right, Frank, bring the cigars.
There you go.
Bring the cigars. Christian loves cigars.
Be tempted. There you go. Great. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it. Glad you're here, both of you. And we'll talk with you soon. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks.
That was Catalina. And this is Scotty out. All right. Well, we are about to enjoy the lunch for the members of Willard, which are those with 25 years of service or more. But before we do, I have an opportunity to sit down with my friend Frank Seltzer, who is the president this year for the TAOM. Hello, Frank. And
hi, Scott. How are you? I'm disappointed that you have not gone out and had a cigar with us yet, but, you know,
we're going to
St. Louis, but, you know, hey.
Well, I was just talking with Christian and Kathleen, and they said they were up until 4 this morning, I guess.
I was up till 3, yeah.
Okay.
I packed it in early.
So I think I'm going to do that tonight.
We had fireworks last night.
I heard them. It was during their lecture,
I know. But we were out, Justin Flom and I and the other brothers, we were all outside. We're all going, wow. It
was, and Danny Garcia was there?
Danny was there, yeah. Danny missed the fireworks. He came out a little later. He was at the bar, so he came out a few minutes later.
Now, that was right over, the fireworks are over the...
right over here, right over the ballpark.
Ballpark, which is where it's a minor league team, basically.
Yep, and they have a lazy river there that people can float and drink and watch the ball game and stuff. There are a couple of guys who want to do that.
So, now, are the fireworks going to be going on any other time, or
Sunday.
Just last night?
Sunday. Yeah.
So tomorrow night, Sunday. Okay, good. Convention-wise, this is great. A lot of fun. You put together a good convention, and the idea from the very get-go, I think it's important. You know, when I was president, and every president has a vision of what you want the thing to look like, and your vision, it seemed to me, was to bring something that TAOM registrants had never seen before.
Yeah, the idea was to bring some of the top creative talent, and these are the young guys who are coming up.
Yeah,
and introduce them to a broader market, and to have the sessioning that we've been having at night, where we're sitting around and ideas are being kicked around. I think a couple of tricks were developed last night as we were just sitting around talking. The vision was to make it not your typical magic convention where you're not seeing the same acts.
Yeah, this is not your grandpa's.
Your grandpa's. And one of the things that I've been trying to do is to get more young people involved, because that's crucial to every magic organization.
Isn't it though?
If we don't get the kids who are sitting on YouTube, we're not going to survive as any organization, SAM, IBM, whatever.
It Rotary, doesn't matter. Whatever.
Everything.
Right.
Yeah, it goes through Toastmasters, Rotary, Gowanus, all of it. Everybody's having the same problems. And that's why I was trying to get this one to make it more creative. And then it was so much fun that Justin Flom just flew in just to be with us.
Yeah, that was cool. He wasn't even part of the convention.
No.
And also, he wasn't here for the whole convention. He was here for like 24 hours.
Well, no, he came in Thursday night.
Oh, Thursday, okay.
Thursday night, and I picked him up Thursday night, and then he left just a little bit ago.
Now, was he a buddy of yours that you've known for a long time?
No, I met him last year at Magic Live. Bizarro introduced me to him.
Yeah.
And we hit it off, and I was trying to book him for this, because when I'd asked the SYM members, the Society of Young Magicians, who do they want to see at a convention? Because they weren't even sure what a convention was. And I said, everybody said Justin Flom. And then I worked with the guys at Penguin, with Brent Braun and them. I said, you know, who are the top magicians who you have? And Ricky Lax is another one, but Ricky doesn't travel outside of Vegas. And so Justin was number one. So I kept trying, and his schedule wasn't going to work out. And then I was at a cigar convention in Vegas, and I was able to bring Justin over to a party. And then he realized that everybody who made the cigars that he liked knew me. And he goes, who is this
Your
guy?
Your name keeps coming up.
Yeah, he said, who is this guy? And so it was just fun. And we just hit it off and had a great time. And I think Justin enjoyed just being here and hanging. And that's what I wanted this to be, a convention where you kind of hang out.
So there really is a conflict. And that's why he wasn't able to come and perform?
Yeah. He had his conflict. But... and he also doesn't want to be away from his wife and kid too long, you know.
Sure.
And
he travels a lot.
He travels an awful lot, and I said, thank your wife for letting you come out and play this weekend,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So what other surprises or, you know, for people who have who are on the ledge and thinking about coming out, I mean, that we're going to have a day pass available for somebody to come out tomorrow?
Day passes are available, and on Monday we're having a special thing. There was a film debuted at Magic Live called Gambler's Ballad about Johnny Thompson, and we will have a private screening of that over at Randy Pitchford's house. In the Peacock Theater, which is similar to like Brookledge.
That's on Monday?
That's on Monday,
awesome.
Monday afternoon. It's a special
that.
Thing, right? It's going to be limited to about 45 of our attendees. I'll give them the information on it. But Randy has graciously opened up the theater for us and said, hey, you know, if you guys want to come over and see the film, you can.
So because they filmed it actually in his...
Yeah. I was there for that. It was right after Magic Live, yeah.
Okay.
I was there for that performance when they filmed that.
Last year.
And so it's been great. And... You know, Frisco is kind of a magical town, considering that Randy Pitchford is the guy who owns Genie now. And terrific guy. He's been a big supporter of magic and the variety arts. And I wanted to kind of, if you look in the program, we've got a little bio about him because he is important.
Yeah. Yep, he is. You know, that in this convention, I noticed that you had not only that, but also a nice write-up about Paul Osborne.
Right. Paul was going to design the program for us, but then he unfortunately passed before that happened. But I wanted to call that back for, and that was Doug Anderson's idea, and Michelle's here, you know, selling the illusion systems and stuff like that. So it's a good thing.
Very nice, very nice. Yeah, just a little bit earlier, I'd spoken with Catalina. I think I may have mistakenly said Richard Pitchford instead of Randy Pitchford.
Randy, yeah.
But yeah, Richard was actually Cardini. So.
Yeah. Well, you're close, you know.
That's right.
This is a granduncle, but you know.
All right. Well, great. Thanks very much.
Sure.
It's a great
job. It's a lot of fun, and it's, for me, there are too many magic conventions that are the same, and we're just trying to. Oh, you have to turn off your phone. Okay. It's just a matter of making it fun, and I'm hoping that people will hang out at night, and everybody's approachable. One of the other things I did besides getting top creative talent is who's going to hang out and be available to people throughout the convention. I don't want somebody who's going to come out, do the show, go up to their room.
Right.
Everybody we've got here is available. They'll talk to you anytime. The other brothers are just so creative. They're doing Shim Shi's show, which is going to take another year. Shim Shi comes in this afternoon, and he'll be closing the show on Sunday night.
Right.
So we got just a great array of talent.
It's going to be great. Yeah, and for those of you who are listening to this daily podcast and are somewhere in the area and you can get away, and but even if you're in Houston, you can drive on up. Please do. You're going to enjoy it. Another great TAOM. Thank you, Frank, for putting
on
a good
Scott.
One.
Thank you.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was President Frank Sulzer. This is Scotty out.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Boy, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back at TAOM. The last time I was here, boy, it's been years ago. It was actually, I think, like I was here twice, before the Willard book came out, after the Willard book came out. Now here we are again, which is great. I'm happy to be here. It's a great group, and it's like family. It really is. Texas is like unlike anywhere else in the world. I don't have to tell you that. usually when we talk about Willard the Wizard, most people think of Harry Willard. How many knew Harry Willard or saw Harry Willard? Got to be a few here. There are a few here. That's great. That's great. And Walter Blaney wanted to be here. He's stuck on his island, as he said, in Houston, but he wanted to be here. He's high and dry, but five blocks away, he said it's wet in all directions. He couldn't get out to be here, so thinking of him, though. But he saw Willard back in 1948 under the tent, so that goes back a ways. And not a lot of people remember the tent, but Willard, when we talk of Willard the Wizard, usually it's Harry Willard, but the Willard family, actually, there were at one time four different men performed as Willard the Wizard, and a lot of people don't know that. So in writing the book, I started the book in 2006. I thought this will be easy because all the main players are still around. Madeline, Francis, Jean, the kids are all still around, lots of material. Well, I started this project, and 6 months turned into 2 years. So it was a snowball, and when this happened, I wasn't prepared for the story in terms of the drama backstage and on stage that happened in the Willard family, and it's really remarkable. And I say it took that long to write it and put it together. Mike Caveney published it, and we are just about sold out of all the copies, as far as I know. But as I mentioned, the Willard family, you have to go back about 100 years before this picture was taken of Harry Willard. That's about 1960. Go back to 1860. which was his father, James Maroney Willard. Now, he was born in New York, not in Ireland, but in New York. And his father, Thomas Willard, whom people said was a magician in Ireland, not true. He was a laborer and immigrated to the United States about 1840 during the potato famine era. And he settled in New York, raised several children, and James was the one who decided to take up magic. And at that time, there was a magician performing as the great wizard of the North, a man named John Henry Anderson. He was performing around New York, and no doubt James Willard saw the great wizard of the North and decided to then call himself Willard the Wizard. So he went on the road beginning in about 1875, and in 1880 he was in part of a dramatic stock company and the dramatic repertory shows. You know what a rep show is, usually performed under a tent. And it's a show where they change it several times during the week. It's various one or two act plays with what they call an olio in the middle, meaning an intermission act. And in that case, it was usually James Willard. And he worked his way in 1880 out to California. And in California, he met a young lady named Lucy May Kiefer. Now, Lucy May was part of a wealthy family out in Chico, California, Northern California, and not too far from where I live in Oregon, just northern part of California. And James was attracted to Lucy May. She was part Cherokee Indian, a family, and struck by her beauty, and she was intrigued by his magic. And so they married in about 1880 and hit the road. And she was 16 years old at that time. The early Willard show presented mysteries right out of the pages of Professor Hoffman, Modern Magic, which many of you are familiar with, maybe a book you started with, like I did, Modern Magic. And the highlight of the show, though, was an effect called the cotton bandage test, or what we now call the spirit cabinet. And they were not the first to do it, but it was presented by the Davenport brothers and also presented by a woman named Anna Eva Fay. But the Willards refined it, did it in their own way, and it became a trademark of their show. And as you know, Frances still performs it to this day. She hasn't performed it lately, but she does, and Hannah, her daughter, performs it as well with her husband, Michael Amar. So as show business was changing in the 1880s, the Willards decided that they really wanted to take control of their own destiny. They didn't want to perform in theaters, because theaters at that time, there was really no national theater circuit in the 1880s where variety acts would appear. Vaudeville really hadn't gelled yet until the 1890s. And so the Willards decided, hey, we need a place we can perform, an area, a territory that will be our own and our own way of doing it. Well, because James had performed under a tent with rep shows, he thought, why not take a magic show, put it under a tent, and go out on the road? And he felt the best place to do that was Texas, because there's a lot of square footage and square miles in Texas to work and lots of little towns. And so they hit the road, started with a small tent, and over the years it grew. Now, the state of Texas, as you know, according to my records, 268,581 square miles in Texas. Now, that is about the whole size of the eastern seaboard, so it made sense for him to, you know, come down here. The weather was good for the most part. You could play late into the year, and so it was an ideal situation for them to work. By the turn of the 20th century, the Willard Show was performing, of course, under their own tent. The tent grew, and again, like a dramatic stock company, they moved every week. They'd set up the show on a Sunday, usually, sometimes Monday, because of the blue laws, you couldn't set up on Sunday. So they'd set up on a Monday, they'd then perform through Saturday, tear it all down, move down the road, go to a different town. And in those days, they're doing it with horse and wagon, and then later, after the turn of the century, started doing it with trucks. So the show grew and grew and grew over the years, as you'll see here. My notes here. James started grooming his son, Robert Willard, who was the oldest son in the family, and Robert was born in 1885, and he started grooming Robert to be the next Willard the Wizard. And Robert grew up in the show with his older sister, Edith, and Edith was born in 1882, so there were two Willard children at that time. And Robert's life revolved around the show so much, in fact, he didn't go to school. He just lived on the show and devoted to the show. He couldn't really read or write very well, but again, his whole focus was show business. And his goal was to take over the next generation of Willard the Wizard. Unfortunately, things really went horribly wrong in Robert Willard's life. By 1912, he had been married three times. And he had two children, but he had a difficult time finding work as a magician in vaudeville. He wanted to go on the stage and not under the tent, because at that time, vaudeville was fast-paced. Acts were short, 8 minutes, 12 minutes for the most part, and his feature being the spirit cabinet, like his father, it took too long to do, and it was too slow, so he couldn't find any work. He was in Cincinnati. In 1913, he began drinking and really hit rock bottom because he couldn't find work. And unfortunately, in December of 1913, he was arrested and booked on charges of murdering his wife and daughter in a hotel in Cincinnati. Really a tragic event. And he was set for trial in July of 1914. But before that happened, Robert took his own life in the Hamilton County Jail. So again, a very tragic event, which the family really never talked about, for good reason. And they soldiered on, though. And at that point, James Willard, the father, said, well, Robert's not going to be the wizard, so the next in line was Harry, who was born in 1895. So Harry was about 20 years old, and Harry had to go to Cincinnati and claim his brother's body and bring it back to Texas to bury him. And he said that affected him his entire life, Harry. So if you knew Harry, there was a lot going on in Harry Willard's mind. Although he was the next in line to be Willard the Wizard, Harry really didn't want to be a magician, which sounds surprising when you think of how long he was a magician. He initially did not want to be a magician. He wanted to be a circus guy. He wanted to perform magic, but he wanted to be in the circus. And he was a slack wire walker, actually performed on the slack wire, and worked in the show, the Molly Bailey Show, which was a small show and actually became a fairly big show, worked around southern part of Texas. And Molly Bailey was kind of like a mother to him when he was on the road, because he was about 20 years old at this time when he was on this show. He performed as Prince Willard. It's kind of hard to see in the photographs, but he has a table, Prince Willard. And again, he did that. He did the slack wire act as well. He was on Christie Brothers Circus as well. And on Christie Brothers, he actually fell off of the slack wire, broke his leg pretty badly, and it was quickly set by a country doctor at that time. So he had always had a little bit of a limp and a little bit of a stride when he walked. And it prevented him from being a slack wire walker again. He couldn't do the circus things he wanted to do. So he decided in about 1919, he decided to come back to the family show. So again, at this time, the show was still being presented by James, the father. And one day, James would go out. He would actually book the show in the day. He'd go ahead to the next town, find somebody to sponsor the show, and then come back at night and perform the show. Well, Harry came back and he was working on the show. One day James said he had to leave and go to the next town to try to get it booked and get it set up. Well, showtime was getting close and James was nowhere to be seen. So Harry put on the costume and for the first time he performed as Willard the Wizard. Well, during the show, James did get back to the tent and he sat in the back and he watched the show. And he said, okay, Harry, you're it. You're ready. And so from that day on, it was Harry Willard presenting the show and James Willard booking the show and presenting the show and getting it town to town. So the two of them worked as a team, father and son. And the Roaring Twenties were really good years for the Willard Show. They were lots of territory to play. There was no radio, no television really of any, no entertainment of any sort other than in these small towns. The circus might come to town once a year. You might get a rep show or Chautauqua performance, or you had Willard the Wizard. And it became a route every year, as many of you know. I mean, he worked every year the same towns or every other year, because again, he had a big place to work here in Texas. In 1921, Harry met a young lady, Charlotte Katzmark. She was known as Lottie. They married in 1921. She was 15 years old at the time, and she became part of the show. And that's a picture of Harry and Lottie and James on the wedding day. And Lottie was taught all of the tricks of the trade. That's a unique version of the broom suspension, which actually rises by itself and rotates. And again, this is 1920, so nothing's new. And they were doing this again under the tent. And in 1923, they had two children, Rosemary and Howard, who was named for Howard Thurston. Howard was born in 1923 and Rosemary in 1925. But again, tragedy struck the Willard family in 1927. Lottie contracted tuberculosis, and she died December 1st, 1927 at 21 years old. So Harry was now a widower with two kids at age 32. And so he hit the road again and kept going. That was the thing about Willard. They always had the tent, they had the trucks, they had this little close-knit city of their own, so to speak, with the family. So there was always the safety of that
tent and that whole surrounding that they, every week, it never changed. The town might change, but all the surroundings stayed the same with the Willard Show. In 1928, Harry met Essie J. Joy. She was 17 years old. She was from Fort Worth. She was a dancer, actually a Charleston dancer, and she had won the Charleston contest in Fort Worth, where she beat out another dancer named Ginger Rogers. So they married in 1929, and by 1930, Harry and Joy had a son, Eugene Powell Willard, named for the magician Frederick Eugene Powell, who was a friend of the family. You may know Gene and Dorothy, great people. And despite the Depression, the Willards kept going. They would sometimes accept food and livestock from people in the audience during the Depression for admission to the show. Bring a chicken, you can get in the show. Bring a bag of potatoes, you can get in the show. And the show just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. At one time, they had 17 trucks on the road. 17 trucks. Calliope, animals, and a tent that would seat about 2,000 people. You could expand and contract this tent down. It was a 5-center pole tent. There's a picture of it. That is a big tent. And they would set that up, as I say, every week. And with their own labor, and then the townies, the guys who would be picking off the street, come out and do it. During the Depression, there were a lot of folks who didn't have work, so they could set up the tent. But they often had problems. I'm going off script here. Gene told me a story. They were in one town, and they'd set up the tent, and it's there. And a guy comes over from next door and says, you know, that tent's on my property. My property line is, you know, right here, and your tent's, you know, over here. It's like 4 feet over the property line. And they said, well, what do you want us to do? He said, move it. So they had to take this tent and pick it up and move it about, it was more than 4 feet, it was about 10 feet or 20 feet over. So they moved that whole tent once that thing was set up and jack it over there. It's, you know, it's amazing. But they put up with this stuff every week to do the show. And it was not a small show. The thing about the Willard Show is it was actually 3 shows each week. You would come in a small town, you'd come on Monday or Tuesday night, you'd see one show. And Harry'd say, come back tomorrow night, come back on Wednesday and Thursday, you'll see a completely different show. And it was a completely different show. Then you'd come on Wednesday and Thursday and see the show, and you'd say, come back on Friday or Saturday, you'll see a completely different show. And they did a completely different job. I'm not talking a couple of tricks. They carried 60 different illusions and tricks that they could change out and perform 3 complete different shows of magic each week, which is pretty remarkable when you think about it. You know, just to have carry that around and then plus be able to perform it and present it. And things like the cannon and the nest of trunks, the sawing, big props, the stretching illusion. Things like this. I mean, it was a big, big show. And to do that every week, again, out in the middle of nowhere with the variable of storms and weather and wind and all the things that can happen under a tent, it was remarkable. Well, by the early 1930s, the other son, Tommy Willard, who was Harry's brother, he started getting the magic bug as well. He didn't really have a choice. He was in the family, so he was going to be a magician. And there was another magician around at the time, a man named Wilbert Willis Holly, a man named Melroy. Anybody remember Melroy? There's a name. He was down in the southern part of the state, and he was a mentalist who would perform on the radio. He performed on XERA, right across the river from Del Rio in Mexico, and it was a 1 million watt radio station. You've probably heard about it. I mean, it was the most powerful radio station in the world. You could be heard in Russia. It was that strong of a signal. And Russians learned English by listening to XERA. And Melroy, before the FCC got into the fold of regulating radio a lot, he would do readings of, tell people, send in your question to Melroy, and I will tell you your fortune or your story and all that. He was the apostle of mental science, he called himself. And he made a lot of money. He would get as many as 17,000 letters a week. 17,000 letters a week coming in because of this broadcast on XERA. You could hear it all over the country at night. And in the first 8 months of 1932, Melroy allegedly netted $200,000. $200,000. So he had a lot of money in his pocket, and he said, you know what? I'm going to put out a big magic show like the Willards. Because I'm here in Texas, they can do it, I can do it, I've got all this money, I can certainly do this. Well, he didn't know the first thing about the tent show business. He bought trucks that were too long, they would go over a railroad track and they'd high center because of the berm on the track. He bought every illusion out of the Thayer catalog in Los Angeles. Thayer sent it. He would tear out a page of the Thayer catalog and write on it, build this. And Thayer would get this sheet. He didn't know which to build. There were like four illusions on the page. He'd build all four and send them to Melroy, and it was fine. And Melroy just kept sending him money. And he just had one of the biggest magic show in the world. Unfortunately, I say, he did not know how to present a show. So he came in 1933 after he built this big show, and he contacted Willard and said, you know what? You guys know how to do a tent show. I really don't. So if you'd like to take out my props and my show, you can do my stuff, and it'd be great. And he would, you know, give him the money, of course, you know, the admissions. So, and take a cut. So Tommy decided to go out, and he went out as not Willard, but as Melroy for a while. For about one season, Tommy Willard presented the show as Melroy. And this, again, in lots of towns down south. Great stand of posters there. And that's, but again, the show went out as Melroy, which is unusual, but it was a good training ground for Tommy because he was young and it gave him the opportunity to really perfect the show. But after about a season, Melroy got tired of that because he realized that Willard was getting all the glory and Melroy wasn't. So he said, nope, enough of that. So at that point, Tommy decided to perform as Willard, but because Harry was out as Willard the Wizard, he went out as Willard the Magician. So there were two Willards at one time traveling through Texas, one in the north part, one in the south part of the state. So they kind of divided up the state into their own territories. And Tommy presented a little more updated show. Harry's show was more old school magic, things again out of Hoffman, things that James had done. And it was, Tommy decided, you know, this is the 1920s, 1930s, I need to make this updated. There was, he performed with a French accent, and as Monsieur Willard from Paris, Paris, Texas. And no one ever questioned that. He had his own jazz band who performed on the stage. There's the Willard Orchestra on stage. He had big props, big floral production. He had lots of animals, including a live bear that traveled with the show. And he also had other acts in the show, including S.S. Henry, a man you may know lived in Houston near the end of his life in the 40s. S.S. Henry was a great magician. So again, by the mid-30s, the Willards had Tommy and Harry, between the two of them, had two of the largest magic shows in the world, and still traveling, you know, the roads of Texas and doing their own thing. They would do a little bit in Louisiana and some into Arkansas, but primarily Texas. That was their territory, as you probably know. And pardon me as I move ahead here. So it was by 1936, I said, they had this huge show, but unfortunately, again, fate reared its ugly head. In June, while playing in Jacksonville, Texas, 1936, Tommy Willard became ill. He was hospitalized with an ulcerated stomach, and ulcers. And the family rallied around him. It looked like he was doing better. And then James Willard returned to booking Harry's show in Louisiana. And on June 22, 1936, he died of a heart attack in Houma, Louisiana, at age 76. This is their father, James. So James died, and then about 2 weeks later, July 6th, 33-year-old Tommy Willard died. So that left Harry Willard the last man standing. And it, again, losing your father and your brother within a couple of weeks of each other, now Harry was the heir apparent. He had 17 trucks, two full tent shows, all this stuff. And what does he do? Well, hit the road. That's what they did. Despite everything, Harry felt a responsibility to his audiences. I mean, the show was big. And it was honed, of course, from literally thousands of performances. It was really a well-oiled magic machine. It's a really rare poster there. Never seen that in person. Things looked a little brighter in 1938 for the Willard family when Madeline was born, and in 1940, Francis was born. They, of course, were part of the show right from the day one. They were out on stage. Willard kept going through the war years, and it was despite gasoline and tire rationing. And when the war ended, Harry Willard thought show business would be better, but times were changing. Entertainment was changing. The quaint little tent show now had kind of been surpassed by radio, right in your home, and television started coming in. And the other thing, air-conditioned theaters. You didn't have to sit under the hot tent. You could watch a movie in air-conditioned comfort. Willard kept going, though. The audiences started to dwindle, but he said, nope, I'm still going to keep it on the road. It forced him, though, to perform longer and longer seasons. He would stay out longer into the fall, which is dangerous with the weather. In November of 1946, they still had the tent out in Grand Saline, Texas, and a late fall storm blew in, and it blew the tent to pieces. The show without a tent headed back to San Antonio, and on the way, Harry was driving the house car, which was his truck, which they lived in, and he stopped at a tavern in LaGrange for a beer, then got out and noticed the back tire was smoking. Well, he went in and got the fish bowl that had water in it. He scooped the fish out and put them in a glass of water. He took this bowl of water and threw it on the rear tire to stop it smoking. He went in, sat down, had a beer, and as the family and the other cars are driving up, they see this entire house car completely engulfed in flames. It caught on fire. Fire started in the back and went up through the closet and burned the entire thing down. So they not only lost the truck and their home, basically, on the road, they also lost the cash box that contained all of the money from the season. This is the end of the season. They lost all the money. They also lost the ticket and receipt ledger, which came back to haunt them, as you'll find out. The Texas Magicians held a benefit show for them, but Harry's pride prevented him from accepting a check. They did a show for him, and they gave him a check. He said, I want the check, and he needed the money, but he was too proud to take it. The photo, it's hard to see here, but there's Dave and Pauline Coleman, Plato and Jewel, Harry and Joy, Ren and Billy Clark, Virgil and Julie, and Doc and Ann Mahendra. And that's at that show. By 1952, the family was still performing, but the government caught up with them. The feds attached the show in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and they claimed that Willard owed back taxes on the tickets that he had sold during the 1946 season. Of course, all the ticket stubs and receipts and everything had been burned up in the house car. So they had no way to verify how much money they had made and how the expenses. Harry had never raised the prices on the show. He thought that despite the economy and people making more money, he said, nope, everyone needs to see the show. 10 cents and 20 cents admission still in those days. But despite that, they packed the tent and they were making a lot of money up to a point. So in 1952, Doc Mahendra came in after the tent was attached by the federal government. They took it in Houma, Louisiana, or in the Baton Rouge. They took the tent, they took everything, his props, everything, and they seized it and said, you know, we're going to hold on to this in part payment. And it was Doc Mahendra who went to the feds and said, you know, without the tent and without magic, Harry Willard, he will never pay you back because he has to perform. And so they said, okay, and they released a little trailer of magic for him to go to the IBM convention up in St. Louis to perform in 1952. Now, the convention in St. Louis, it was held at the Kiel Opera House. I don't know if you've been there. I've performed on this stage. It seats 6,000 people. The stage is 120 feet wide and 60 feet deep, which is about the size of Willard's tent at that time. He was overwhelmed on this stage. He didn't want to use a microphone because he didn't use a microphone in the tent, and no one could hear him. And the magicians all kind of said, Willard, the wizard, the greatest magician in the world. Really? Really? He was way out of his element. The show was good, but again, it was in the wrong environment. And Harry really had a breakdown after that show. He went to Louisiana and just kind of gave up at that point, but he also ended up, he had tuberculosis as well. So he ended up in a tuberculosis sanitarium at that time and recovering. But at the same time, his wife Joy found out she had breast cancer at age 42. And her condition got worse, and she passed away December 18th, 1953. So here's Harry with no show, no wife, a family to support. It was really not good. But he still, in his mind, knew he had magic. He was a magician, and that's what he did. And so he slowly, again, started moving on and moving on. His son, youngest son, Patrick, was killed by a car, to add insult to injury, and it, again, really deeply affected him in 1957. He soldiered on, the tent was gone, this was the tent in 1957, it was a trailer a little top out on the side and some seats. That's Bev Bergeron's car there. He was on the show at that time. And Harry decided, keep moving. That's all he knew. And again, to know what he had and now to be reduced to this, it was tragic. But he was always optimistic. And while the public kind of turned their back on Willard the Wizard, this was at the time when magicians really started to embrace him and understand, and many of you in this room saw him, when he started performing at conventions. And his Anne Mahendra there with him on stage. This is a TAOM, I think, in about 1960 that picture was taken. And Francis, of course, and his other daughter, Rosemary. And they buoyed him up and kept him going. And it was the acclaim of the magicians, people like you, who really kept Harry Willard alive and made him realize that what he had done was significant. I mean, here was a guy, again, who had spent his entire life in magic. And to get the love of the magicians and realize that all this work he had done was not in vain, that people loved him and appreciated what he had done, I think that really made a difference in his life. And of course, in 1964, the IBM ring here was named the Willard the Wizard ring. And Frances, when she started performing the Spirit Cabinet, she told me, I said, how much rehearsal did you do? She said, we rehearsed for about an hour. She said, my dad, we did the cabinet once. He said, I'm going out for a beer. You know what to do. And she said, she did it. But she said, the one thing where she had seen her mother do it every show for years. So she felt a little bit calm, but she said she was nervous as could be when she first did it. And that picture, there's Claude Crowe right here on stage. But I say, Harry kept going. The Magic Castle gave him a Lifetime Achievement Fellowship in 1970 and realized, again, he was the last of his generation. He was the last guy who, you know, really did it his own way. He created his own destiny. He could perform anywhere and do whatever he wanted to. He was not really at the mercy of anyone. And that's, and again, he was the last of that era. There were not as many regulations and things to keep you down, and Harry Willard, he loved his audiences. I mean, every show he did, it was all about the audience. And he would not cut a show, he would not do less just because there were fewer people in the audience. He said, nope, doing the full show, because the people who paid 20 cents to be here deserve to see the show. So he did that time and time again. So again, really the last of an era. And he did live to see the world around him change from the era of the horse and buggy to the space age. And he was kind of that last linked to the horse and buggy era, so to speak, in the world of magic. But, you know, he was really appreciated for what he did. By the time he died, he knew that a lot of people loved him, and the magic that he presented was unlike anything that anyone has done or has ever done since. The Willards were really remarkable in what they had done. Harry died on June 28, 1970, in San Antonio, age 75, and he's remembered today as really one of the world's greatest magicians. When I was writing this book, everyone, and I mean everyone I talked to, I said, who was the greatest magician you ever saw? They said, Harry Willard, without a doubt. Blackstone, Dante, Thurston, no, Harry Willard. Anybody who saw him said he was the world's greatest magician. And I say he was the world's greatest magician, but I think from what you've seen and heard, you could also call him probably the world's greatest survivor. And that's Harry Willard. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, well, it's the afternoon still on the second day, and I thought it'd be kind of interesting to speak with someone who is not only a very longtime friend of mine from going back in the 80s, early 80s, yeah, but also someone who is the answer to some questions that have been put out there. We'll get to that in just a minute, but my buddy Eric, but you know him as Fumio Inagaki. Mm-hmm. Hey.
Yep. Fumio.
Yes. Eric. It feels so funny to call you Fumio.
I have very limited vocabulation. I'm from Tokyo.
From Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And you, when we first met, you were in Odessa, Texas.
Yes.
When I was living
back
in
Midland. Back in 1983.
80. Yeah. Yeah. And you have since worked, then you moved back to Tokyo and you worked cruise ships and working restaurants and everything.
Sure. Yeah. I worked. Fortunately, I worked a lot of places and then never been to a cruise line. And mm-hmm. then I got on a cruise line, like three different vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I'm here and then hopefully I start working on the cruise line.
Something here now that you're back in the States. And yeah. So the reason that, one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you also is just to let everybody know that you are the creator of the UPC gag.
Oh, yeah. Fumio's computer prediction. That's what them call it. I call it.
Because we were at a convention a while back, and I remember Eric Buss had, you know, was doing a trick, and he'd said, is there anybody here who knows the origin of who was invented that? And I said, sure do. And he said, you're the first person ever in any lecture I've ever had who knows that. And I said, I was there. I know the whole story. So I thought it'd be interesting to kind of hear the story from the horse's mouth. So why don't you tell me about how this all happened?
Yeah, well, it was kind of stupid of me because I'm not a computer whiz to begin with. And then one day after I got off work, and then I went to Albertson, Skaggs Albertson, and I bought me a sneakers. And it's at the time, the stores start having the UPS coordinate.
They just started using the BBPC gags back then.
So I just wondered how in the world she can tell, they can tell you its product and the price.
Yeah.
It's, you know, when you go through
in that, the beep, yeah.
Yeah, beep, you know. So kind of, you know, jokingly, I just made it up.
Yeah.
Barcode and then started doing it to people. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to read your mind.
Right.
But it ended up with people laughing. So
right.
I took it to Tom Ogden in Hollywood, and then he said he took it to Max Maven, and then he said, why don't I think about things like that, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how this started. And then next thing I find out, a lot of musicians doing it as a gag, and then a lot of MC and comedians. And then one day I came home to watch a Johnny Carson show in the Central Time, of course.
Yeah.
And then Doogie Howser was a guest.
Neil Patrick Harris, yeah.
Yeah. And then Johnny said to him that, I understand you're into magic right now. And he said, yeah, I have something. I want to show you something. He did on the national TV.
Yeah.
The barcode. So I called Tom Ogden.
Yeah.
Which 2 hours different, you know, like,
right.
You know, Central.
From Central to Pacific. Time, yeah.
So he hasn't seen it. And the next day he called me. I called him. I don't remember. But now million people saw, you know, saw that gag.
Yeah.
So he said, I cannot do it anymore. Something like that, you know.
Well, filling in just a few of the blanks, as I recall, whenever that you'd come up with that, that was something, obviously, that people have been doing the baby gag for years, you know.
Yes, yes.
And you had used the baby gag then as well.
Yes, I used the baby gag, but when I won the special merit through IBM Original Contest in 1985, people were judging my gag, and then they said that it's the best mind-reading gag after the baby gag.
Yeah.
Baby gag. Yeah.
Well, let me give you a little bit of history on that also, because I was involved with that a little bit back at that time, because Phil Wilmarth, who was the editor of the Linking Ring magazine, had come to me and he said, this was a gag, you know, or something that was presented as being for the trick of the year, and we're considering it, and someone said that it's really not, doesn't belong to Fumio. And I said, well, I know the story of this.
Yeah.
I said, the deal is, Tom Ogden had come to town. He had performed and done a lecture for us there in Midland. And while he was at my house, that Fumio came over and was showing him this. And he said, that was great. And that he said, well, won't you take it back to L.A., work it out in comedy clubs? And he was giving you full credit. And so I said, Phil, if you'll talk then with Tom will admit that, hey, this is not my idea. This is Eric's. I mean, Fumio's,
well,
you know.
Thank you.
So that's why that I think you may not have gotten it the first year, because they thought it wasn't original, that it was Tom's idea that you had put in. And then after we corroborated, then the next year you won that award.
Yes, that is correct. And I did not know you were involved in that.
Yeah.
And thanks so much, Scott.
Well, you're my buddy.
Yeah, thank you. And that was about 1985, which is how many years ago was that?
30 years ago.
They still, just like yesterday, that performer, the mind reading performer.
Oh, that's right, Christian Painter and Catalina.
He was using that.
Berkeley. Oh no. That was Gregory Wilson. I'd forgotten who was.
Couple.
Oh, it was Christian and Catalina. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So anyhow, that's just kind of the background of the story. I thought that you guys might like to hear the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say then as well.
Good day.
Good day to you, sir. That's right. And so anyhow, that was Fumio Inagaki, and that is the rest of the story.
Good day.
That was Fumio. This is Scotty out. Oh, let me take a picture.